This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, September 1, 2005. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. Desperate Louisiana residents nervously wait to be evacuated from New Orleans as the city sits in a toxic soup. The immigration case of Luis Posadas Cariles is halted as his defense unexpectedly changes strategy. And Indonesia releases over 1,400 GOM prisoners. We'll hear about their bittersweet sentiments about getting back home. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Leanne Caldwell with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Israeli and Egyptian officers signed an agreement to deploy lightly armed Egyptian troops along the border of the Gaza Strip, although ultimate control over the border will remain in Israeli hands. Leila El-Haddad reports from Gaza.
Under the agreement, Egypt will deploy some 750 of its troops along the border with Gaza beginning as early as Sunday. The troops are meant to prevent possible weapons smuggling from Egypt into Gaza following the Israeli disengagement from the territory. The deal was signed despite the fact that no agreement has yet been reached with the Palestinian Authority on who will ultimately control the borders after Israel's pullout from Gaza. Israel insists on maintaining control over the Rafah crossing, the only route to the outside world for Gaza's 1.4 million Palestinians. Israel is relocating the crossing farther southeast to a point where the Egyptian, Gaza, and Israeli borders meet, despite opposition from Egypt and the Palestinian Authority. The new location would allow Israeli troops to control Palestinian movement in and out of Gaza without physically being present in the Strip, bolstering their argument that they are no longer occupying the area. Palestinians reject the proposal. For Free Speech Radio News in Gaza, I'm Leila El-Haddad.
1 year ago was a siege on a school in Beslan, Russia, that ended with the death of 331 people, half of them children. Family members grieved and expressed anger at Russia's President Vladimir Putin, blaming him for the deaths caused partly by a poor rescue plan. Putin offered a moment of silence while visiting a city 300 miles away from Beslan. The school was attacked by Chechnya rebels who have been seeking independence from Russia for over a decade. The U.S. removed some export restrictions on six Indian civilian nuclear and space facilities, signifying better relations. From New Delhi, Vinod K. Jose reports.
United States has taken India off the list of countries on which it imposes unilateral restrictions for non-proliferation reasons. The U.S. Embassy in Delhi said that the U.S. administration allowed six Indian entities involved in civil nuclear and satellite work to purchase U.S.-made items without special licenses. The NP2 list includes Iraq, Pakistan, Israel, North Korea, and Libya, apart from India. In May 1998, Washington had imposed sanctions on India following its nuclear tests. But earlier this year, it agreed to increase cooperation on civilian nuclear energy programs. The decision to enhance civilian nuclear energy cooperation was reached during a visit by Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh to Washington in July. From New Delhi, in India, I'm Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
In their first full day on the road, Cindy Sheehan and fellow anti-war protesters are hoping to speak with lawmakers other than President Bush. Katie Heim reports.
Cindy Sheehan left Crawford Wednesday afternoon and traveled to the city of Austin, Texas, where she and her supporters met with Representative Lloyd Doggett. Over 2,000 supporters were there to meet her as she kicked off the first leg of her cross-country tour. Doggett was receptive to Sheehan's message and offered the caravan hope. Today, Sheehan and others converge on Houston, Texas, where they are going to the offices of Representative Tom DeLay. DeLay issued a press release earlier this week stating that he will not meet with Sheehan due to his busy schedule and elaborated that he doesn't agree with her mission. Sheehan's tour was diverted from its originally scheduled path into the city of New Orleans because of Hurricane Katrina.
We're not going to stop putting pressure on Congress to bring our troops home. We have National Guard over there in Iraq that should be here helping the people of Louisiana. They have chaos there. The law enforcement and the National Guard there can't handle it.
Houston is accepting thousands of refugees in the aftermath of the Category 4 storm. Sheehan is holding a rally here tonight to draw what some say are important parallels between the lack of resources at home and the wars abroad. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Katie Heim.
Today marks 8 years since the federal government has raised the minimum wage. Darby Hickey has more from Washington, D.C.
Although the federal minimum wage has remained steady since it was last raised in September 1997, inflation has reduced its purchasing power by 17%. That's according to a report by the Economic Policy Institute and Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Over 100 cities and 16 states have adopted higher minimum wages because of inaction on the part of the federal government, says Sean Dobson of advocacy group Progressive Maryland.
It represents a real reversal of, you know, the kind of social contract that held our country together for 200 years, namely that if you work hard and you play by the rules, you ought to live well and live better than your parents did.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Leanne Caldwell at WPFW in Washington, D.C.
Emergency rescue relief efforts continue in southern Louisiana and Mississippi. The U.S. Coast Guard announced that it's rescued about 3,000 people today who have been trapped in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, although 2,000 more remain in New Orleans as conditions grow dire with supplies of food and drinking water diminishing. There are reports of isolated incidents of people in the city breaking into abandoned stores and taking everything from food and medicine to firearms. There are also reports of violence. This morning, President Bush called for the full prosecution of any of the people who engage in such activities, regardless of the motive. Mitch Jezerich brings us this update on the federal government's response to the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina.
Hurricane Katrina is being called one of the largest natural disasters to hit the United States, with estimates of the dead in the thousands, which would make it the deadliest natural disaster since the 1906 San Francisco earthquake. There are still tens of thousands of the living still trapped in New Orleans, including the disabled and the elderly, either huddled on the top of rooftops or drifting through contaminated water that floods the streets. The stranded have become desperate, as food and clean water have become scarce 4 days after the hurricane struck. Secretary of the Homeland Security Department, Michael Chertoff.
We're not only confronting the original disaster of the hurricane, we're confronting the ongoing disaster of the flooding. And for those who wonder why it is that it is difficult to get these supplies and these medical teams into place, the answer is they are battling an ongoing dynamic problem with the water. We're hoping as we turn that around that is going to ease the problem. And of course, the key to resolving the problem is to finally move the people out of New Orleans.
In a written statement, the mayor of New Orleans sent out an urgent SOS today, saying that the Superdome, where thousands of refugees have been put, is out of supplies and that there are not enough buses to get everyone to the Astrodome in Houston. Meanwhile, there are increasing reports of people breaking into stores and taking anything from food and medicines to firearms. Reports indicate that FEMA in some areas had to postpone rescue missions due to safety concerns. The National Guard says that it has 2,800 of its people in the region and that an additional 1,400 Guards persons will arrive each of the next 3 days. Lieutenant General Stephen Blum is a commander of the National Guard Bureau.
This is not, as it has been erroneously reported, martial law. It is not that at all. This is helping a police force that is overstretched with this extraordinary challenge that it's facing. So we are bringing law enforcement officers from around the country that are in the military of the National Guard in state active duty roles.
President Bush this morning told ABC's Good Morning America that he is calling for the full prosecution of anyone involved of illegal activity.
I think there ought to be zero tolerance of people breaking the law during an emergency such as this, whether it be looting or price gouging at the gasoline pump or taking advantage of charitable giving or insurance fraud. And I've made that clear to our Attorney General.
Later on at a White House press briefing, spokesperson Scott McClellan said that there would be no special consideration for people who took shoes, food, water, or other supplies meant for survival.
We understand the need for food and water and supplies of that nature. That's why we have a massive effort underway to continue getting food and water and ice to those who are in need. There are ways for them to get that help. Looting is not the way for them to do it.
There is increasing criticism that the federal government was slow to react to the hurricane, which was known to be a potential disaster 2 days before it struck, and that Louisiana's National Guard was unprepared for such an event because much of it had been deployed to Iraq. Because Louisiana is a major port of entry for oil, later in the day, President Bush announced that there will be a temporary disruption in the flow of gas and that people across the country should cut back on oil use.
Steps we're taking will help address the problem of availability, but it's not going to solve it. Americans should be prudent in their use of energy during the course of the next few weeks. Don't buy gas if you don't need it.
President Bush also summoned his father and former President Bill Clinton to head a fundraising campaign for the stricken areas. Also, Congress is expected to return from its month-long break either tonight or tomorrow to pass an emergency supplemental bill of $10 billion to help keep FEMA operating in the area. Personal donations are being accepted by FEMA and the American Red Cross. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
Desperate crowds of people are crammed shoulder to shoulder against barricades waiting to be evacuated from the Superdome in New Orleans as the city marinates in a toxic soup. As people arrive in Houston, they're being tested for diseases from wading through the water. Others, unable to find assistance, have resorted to sleeping in their cars. From KPFT in Houston, Renee Feltz reports.
Most residents stranded in the flooded city of New Orleans have gone for days without food and water. The behavior of some desperate people has reportedly led most emergency medical personnel to evacuate. One witness said tens of thousands of people are stranded on the streets with no sign of emergency workers. Another said she saw dead babies and women and young and old men with tattered T-shirts or graying temples floating along the streets of the lower Ninth Ward, known for its extreme poverty. Right before airtime, gunshots were reported near a hospital being evacuated. People not left behind in New Orleans are arriving in major Texas cities. 25,000 are now on their way to San Antonio. Houston alone is expected to absorb 100,000 refugees from Hurricane Katrina. The 23,000 mostly young and old people coming from the Superdome began arriving last night to Houston's Astrodome. Among them is 27-year-old Ronnie Jason Jr. of St. Bernard Parish.
Like I said, the water got up like 15 feet, and my sister's still on the second floor. You know what I'm saying? We had to get our churn and my uncle out through the top window. Because, you know, the boat can pull up to the window.
What boat?
It was volunteers.
Local residents?
No, it was St. Bernard Shells. And they took, and what they did, they laid up that it came. They got my girl. They got my nephew. Yeah, and my uncle. But they ain't supposed to did it like that because I know they was going to switch up on us. You know, so they sent somebody out. They claimed they were coming back and get us, the one that took my family. But they ain't come back out. They sent somebody else, and they laid up there and had us, you know, moving all around without our family. We ain't heard nothing from our family or nothing. That's why when I came this way today, before I walked to the store, I asked the man over there, you know, could he at least get on TV and let my family know we all right, and I want to know if they all right.
Many Katrina refugees in Houston are now focusing on contacting their loved ones. Except for text messaging, the 504 New Orleans area code no longer works. Meanwhile, people are searched as they enter the Astrodome. A clinic tests them for exposure to sewage in the floodwaters. Many are also receiving assistance after eating spoiled food or drinking contaminated water. Thursday night, an unofficial bus arrived at the dome, and its 60-plus occupants were accepted, despite earlier claims the dome would only accept Superdome evacuees. Since then, people on foot and without transportation have also been admitted. Others are being housed at community shelters. New Orleans resident Guy Augustine critiqued the evacuation effort.
They could have done a better job. They have RTA transit buses where they could have loaded these people up. I mean, they have hundreds of buses where they can sent them in different, they have wards, like districts in Orleans Parish. I mean, they could have sent out 20 buses in a certain district and loaded those people on and then shuttled them to a higher ground or shut them outside of the city. I mean, I think the mayor as well as the governor, I don't know if they was ill-prepared or didn't have a great conceived plan or understood what really is going to happen. And I really think they dropped the ball in a I mean, we knew the traffic was going to be bad. We knew that. But as for shuttling the people out and having them go into the dome, I mean, it was very inadequate. I think they had a lot of different things they could have done. I don't think they used all the resources that they had.
Most of Houston's 19 area shelters are filling up quickly if they're not already full. Most people on limited incomes have left the hotel rooms they can no longer afford to stay in. One major point remains unclear at this point as far as evacuees being absorbed into the Houston area. In New Orleans, people are still streaming to the Superdome to seek evacuation, and no one knows where they will go after their harrowing ordeal. In collaboration with Valerie Torres, Smiley Maddox, and James Moore, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News in Houston.
The immigration hearing of alleged terrorist Luis Posada Carriles was brought to a sudden halt when his defense team decided to change strategies to get him to stay in the United States and avoid his deportation to Venezuela. The defense will apply for Posada Carriles' U.S. citizenship instead of seeking asylum. FSRN's Dolores Zambranal reports from El Paso, Texas.
Luis Posada Carriles is a Venezuelan national who was born in Cuba. However, since Posada Carriles served in the U.S. Armed Forces in Vietnam and with the CIA in 1961, he can qualify for U.S. citizenship without too many problems. This move by Posada Carriles' defense surprised reporters and Judge William L. Abbott, who cautioned Posada Carriles' lawyers from changing course this far into the asylum application process. And Luis Bardak is the reporter who gathered Posada Carriles' self-incrimination interviews in 1998. The prosecution had on Tuesday used those interviews to grill Posada Carriles. This was Bardak's analysis on the unexpected turn of events on Wednesday.
They felt they were very damaged yesterday, and that they felt that the state was going to continue to damage their client and affect the judge's disposition in the case. They wanted to stem the damage, so they cut this deal today.
The prosecution, the Department of Homeland Security, had on Tuesday made Posada Carriles confess that he had connections with anti-Castro terrorists such as George Kaczynski, who participated in the bombings of Havana hotels in 1987, connections that directly involved Posada Carriles to those bombings. Matthew Archambault, Posada Carriles' defense lawyer, denies that he was beginning to lose the case of his client's asylum and insists that they were forced to take this turn so that Posada Carriles wouldn't divulge U.S. national secrets.
All this happened is because the government decided to start asking areas where it's sensitive for the U.S. government, and Mr. Posada has a lot of information that he could have used to defend himself. Many times when he's taken the Fifth Amendment, it's not only to protect himself, but to protect the United States government. So when they start asking about people like George Kaczynski, if you know the history of Mr. Posada and Mr. Kaczynski, that's going to get in a delicate area.
The judge in the case has now deferred Posada Carriles' deportation hearing to Venezuela until September 26. Meanwhile, the Department of Homeland Security will investigate if, in fact, Posada Carriles will be tortured if he was sent to Venezuela and try to work through diplomacy channels to get assurance from Chavez that Posada Carriles will be treated fairly. This will allow the defense enough time to submit U.S. citizenship papers for Posada Carriles. Dolores Bernal, Free Speech Radio News, El Paso, Texas.
Representatives from the Canadian Media Guild, the union that represents media workers, and the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, or CBC, the country's public broadcaster, began labor negotiations yesterday. The two sides met for the first time since the CBC locked out about 90% of its workers over 2 weeks ago. To air their frustrations about the dispute, a group of CBC employees have started to broadcast worker-focused programming that they're calling CBC Unplugged. Allison Benjamin files this report.
In Canada, there's a lockout at the CBC, the country's national public radio and television broadcasting network. Some 90% of workers, over 5,300, have been locked out because of a contract dispute. Since they've been shut out of their offices, a group of CBC workers have launched a unique type of protest.
You are listening to CBC Unplugged from Studio Zero. You can download a podcast version of this program at cmgvancouver.org. The management has locked us out, but we are doing our best to stay on the airwaves.
We're not going to stop doing what we love. For those people who don't regularly listen to CBC Radio, we're going to tell you what's been happening over the last week or so. If you're a fan of the CBC, thanks so much for switching the dial and sticking with the people who actually make up what you hear and watch every single day.
It's broadcast on community radio stations across Canada and podcast over the internet. Alexis Mazurin, a reporter for CBC Radio 3 and producer for CBC Unplugged, explains.
It's a culmination of us sitting out here, being locked out from our jobs, which we wanted to do,
and sitting around going like, hey, you know what, instead of like sort of getting depressed, you know, it's kind of hard to keep morale up when you're walking around with a sign on around your neck. Why don't we make a radio show, what we usually do?
CBC Unplugged is not endorsed by the Canadian Media Guild, the union that represents most CBC workers, or by the CBC itself. Kelly Ryan is a national reporter for the CBC and also contributed to the show.
We all know there's two sides to every story, and management has a lot of money. They're spending $1 million on advertising every week to tell the public their perspective, and we don't have that kind of cash. We have a very different perspective on what's going on, and we need to get it out.
Jason McDonald is a spokesperson for the management of the CBC.
These kinds of things are all fine, but the problem is that they don't move us any closer toward a solution to the key issue here, which is the need to get back to the bargaining table.
A key issue in the lockout is how the CBC hires its workers. Management wants more freedom to hire contract workers. It argues that flexibility will allow the broadcaster to better respond to the market.
Well, the key issue certainly is the ability, our need to have the ability to hire the right people with the right skills and experiences in the most appropriate way for the particular program or project in question.
The Canadian Media Guild argues that the CBC already has too many contract positions and that hiring full-time workers will be more beneficial for employees and for Canadian public broadcasting. The corporation currently consists of 70% permanent workers, 20% temporary workers, and 5% contractors. Like the British Broadcasting Corporation, the CBC is publicly funded and provides news, entertainment, sports, and information to television, radio, and internet audiences. The labor dispute has altered CBC programming. The remaining 10% of CBC workers not in the union are in charge of the network's schedule, which currently consists of Canadian football games, movies, pared-down newscasts, and reruns. CBC spokesperson Jason McDonald says he doesn't know how long the dispute will last. While CBC Unplugged isn't typical CBC fare, it is a new way for workers to make their voices known. With the help of digital recorders, the internet, and sympathetic community radio stations, its producers are able to share their views about the labor dispute. For Free Speech Radio News in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, I'm Allison Benjamin.
Indonesia began freeing over 1,400 Free Aceh or GAM prisoners yesterday as a result of the Helsinki Peace Agreement signed on August 15, while about 1,000 prisoners remain in jail. Indonesia's government says they were not granted amnesty because they're jailed not for their political activities but for criminal activities such as robbing and killing. As FSRN's Maggie Margiona reports from Jakarta, GAM prisoners who were granted amnesty by the Indonesian government are expressing happiness, but are also worried whether their families survived the devastating tsunami.
This is one of the prisons in Java, built by the Dutch colonial government to jail Indonesian independence fighters in the 19th century. However, today, Indonesia's government imprisons members of the Free Aceh movement in this jail. Sahid is one of the GAM prisoners who was sentenced to 15 years after Indonesia declared martial law in 2003.
Ada saya jelaskan, kenapa Pak jadi begini saya? Sedangkan saya dituntut 12 tahun, kenapa?
I asked the judge why I was sentenced to 15 years by the district court when the prosecutors only demanded 12-year sentence for me. The judge told me not to ask about it. I also did not request a higher court review because a friend told me the higher court sentenced him to 5 years. When the district court has sentenced him to only 3.
Sahid is a fisherman from Muloba, a city on the western coast of Aceh, hardest hit by last year's December 26 tsunami. Only around 2,000 people of his city survived, and Sahid does not know whether his family were among the survivors. He simply says he wants to go back to see his town. Faizan is another prisoner. He was a commander of GAM's police and sentenced to 10 years after the onset of martial law in 2003.
My friends and I have been hoping for amnesty for a long time. We ask God to open the minds of the Indonesian leaders. I appreciate the amnesty. May God bless Indonesia to become a glorious nation, since the amnesty is important for the prisoners that need to go home to Aceh, because their life is now lived under great difficulty.
Like other GAM prisoners, Faizan was judged by a so-called emergency tribunal, under which the suspects are not assisted by lawyers. GAM prisoner and pro-independence cleric Zulfikri says that he was arrested by the Indonesian army while in the midst of prayer and could not run from his captors. Today, Zulfikri is free from prison.
My name is Zofikri. Once I am free, I will dedicate my life to my nation and religion. That has been my idea since I was a child. I want to dedicate my life for my nation and my religion.
Around 50 GOM prisoners celebrated their freedom by playing traditional Aceh music. They'll go home to Aceh soon and find their homeland drastically changed by last year's tsunami. Reading for Maggie Margiono in Jakarta, I'm Monica Lopez for Free Speech Radio News.
An official on indigenous issues from the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights wrapped up a visit this week to Oaxaca, Mexico. The state is home to the largest concentration of indigenous people in the country, with 40% of the population belonging to one of the region's 60 native groups. While many of the cases presented to the commissioner dealt with long-time issues, new and pending legislation are adding a new dimension to the struggle for indigenous self-determination. Vladimir Flores reports from Oaxaca.
We came here to Oaxaca to examine the situation, particularly of indigenous peoples' rights.
José Salaquet is a commissioner from the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, a dependency of the Organization of American States. When investigating the situation of indigenous peoples' rights, Salaquet says that the most common issues are land disputes, violence in the communities, irregularities in the administration of justice, and violations of due process. During his visit to Oaxaca, the Human Rights Commissioner met with state government officials and also held a meeting with non-governmental organizations and civil groups. Aldo González from the UNOSJO, a campesino organization in the heavily Zapotec region of the Sierra Juarez, came to the meeting to denounce pending legislation that he says will negatively affect the rights of indigenous people.
The law of access to genetic resources and the law of industrial property are opening the doors for the privatization of what Western society has called genetic resources, as well as the privatization of traditional knowledge of the indigenous communities. So these laws that are being made treats as resources what we call living beings, and because of this, we cannot agree with Western society in this sense.
Aldo González says that at the heart of the matter is the difference between the Western and indigenous worldviews.
These laws that are being made are going to establish precedents for criminalizing some of the practices of indigenous people, which appears to us to be very dangerous. Also, the laws will be made in such a way that there will be no possibility of establishing a precedent of human rights violations when dealing with these topics in relation to indigenous peoples. So, the human rights watchdog groups will not be able to work with these new laws.
Given that legislation granting private ownership rights of life forms is a relatively new concept, the debate regarding the ethics of such legislation is in the beginning stages. For his part, José Salaquet from the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights showed interest in learning more about the subject.
In the different hearings we held, we learned a lot about new concerns. We have to digest these lessons that we learned from the same community and have a better understanding of the Oaxacan reality so as to act in a more efficient way.
The Human Rights Commissioner was presented with approximately 30 case files during his trip to Oaxaca, which will be taken back to Washington for analysis. Vladimir Flores, Free Speech Radio News, Oaxaca.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.